Hello, this is Ed Markey speaking. Welcome to the Ed Markey Podcast. Okay, so...
Let me know.
Oh, man.
Welcome back to the podcast. I'm here with Representative Maxwell Frost from the state of Florida, from the greater Orlando area. But more than that, he's the first elected congressman from Gen Z in American history. And he's still only 27 years old, but representing an entire generation with more to follow him in Congress, representing the values, the aspirations of Gen Z. And I'm just so proud to be in the climate movement with him. And to a certain extent, Florida is one big science experiment being conducted by the fossil fuel industry. You know, let's see what we can do. To the ocean. Let's see what we can do to the Everglades.
What extremes we can take it to. Yeah.
So could you talk, first of all, what's it like to have 100 degree water off of the coast of Florida last year?
Yeah, literally like hot tub water temperatures surrounding our entire state as a peninsula. And it's doing a bunch of things. Number one, it's killing our biodiversity in Florida. The Everglades are shrinking day to day. And it's creating, the climate crisis in general is creating these conditions that make the state less and less livable as we go along. It's part of the reason you've seen a lot of people leave the state of Florida as well, because it's scary. And you've seen it impact businesses, people, working families, and of course, things disproportionately impact poor and working class people. And so it's highly unfortunate. It's a tragedy. And we see it in our hurricanes, too, that are lasting longer, killing more people, creating more devastation, and we're not, number one, we don't have the resiliency to handle it, but number two, we're not doing anything to stop it.
And you have Donald Trump, who got his climate degree at Trump University, along with your governor, who are climate deniers, and yet this looming threat just continues to grow off of your coastline, but now it's inland as well. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the Everglades. What is the impact of climate change on the Everglades, which is not just Florida's, but America's treasure.
It's America's, and it's the world's. And, you know, the thing about the Everglades, which is talking about biodiversity, the highest amount of biodiversity in our state resides in the Everglades. It's really a model of what Florida has to offer, right, in terms of a state and the environment. And every day, it's shrinking little by little for many different reasons. We see it because of a lot of practices of certain industries around the Everglades. It's because of the greater climate crisis and emissions, and everything is very much connected. And here's the thing, too. In the state of Florida, there tends to be bipartisanship with Republicans and Democrats on climate resiliency in terms of protecting the Everglades. So it's interesting because a lot of Republicans like DeSantis will admit we need to do something to protect it. But then you ask them, why do we need to protect it in the first place? Why do we need this resiliency in the first place? And that's where the whole argument just crumbles apart. Why do we need to improve climate resiliency on the shores of Miami and South Beach, right? And then they have nothing to give you because the answer is the climate crisis, but they're climate deniers.
Yeah, they're climate deniers. So, you know, I come from Massachusetts, and we're like the perfectly cloudy state. And you're like the perfectly sunny state. Mm. And, you know, when there's a few clouds that go over, you know, for a while in the course of a day, it's like, oh, my God, look at those clouds. But then it's sunny again. So in terms of solar power, moving to the solution, and you're the sunshine state.
Yeah.
So are you optimistic that with the climate bill that President Biden passed and, you know, and now the kind of the energy, the drive that young people have, especially that we should move to renewables? Or is this battle with utilities still too hard in order to make the progress that we need? And we know we have to make, but we can make because the technology is there.
Yeah, the technology is there. I mean, it's like both and, right? I mean, number one, the battle against utility is still happening in the state of Florida. It's a difficult one. But the exciting thing is because of the Inflation Reduction Act, we're seeing actually right, not in my district, but right outside the greater Orlando area, there's a ton of land south of an area called St. Cloud that has actually just been purchased to put one of the largest solar farms in the country in the state of Florida, taking advantage of the fact that we are the Sunshine State. And so I think we see good things happening, but we take multiple steps forward because of the IRA, and then we have someone like Ron DeSantis who will reject a lot of the rebates and et cetera that come from the IRA because I guess it's like woke politics. So we're, you know, it's both and. We're still struggling in a big way in the state of Florida, but the good thing is the IRA has, through the tax incentives, has given folks the opportunity to do things around the state of Florida and around Ron DeSantis, and that's why we're getting the solar farm.
So are you optimistic that in the long run we're going to win, but it's just going to be a fight? What do you tell young people and old, you know, that has to happen if we're going to turn the corner and protect the coastline, protect the Everglades by deploying technologies you know, that do no harm?
I mean, I am optimistic. I mean, number one, we look at the Inflation Reduction Act, right? The most money any country has ever put towards defeating the climate crisis. And we need a hell of a lot more. But that wouldn't have been possible without the organizers, advocates, people who have run for office to ensure that we are passing, you know, climate-friendly and climate-forward legislation so that way we have a world to live in. And the thing that I look at oftentimes, especially in the movement spaces, for a lot of time in the climate movement, you know, it was a lot about protecting our future, which that's still what it's about. But now when you hear chants and you hear people talking, it's not just about protect our future, it's about protect us now. Like, people are dying and being displaced now because of the climate crisis. It's already here. But the good news is we can still have an impact on the worst parts of it.
Yeah.
Right? And that's really where the conversation has come.
And you and I, we have a legislation, the SAFE Act. That
Save Through Medicare.
Under Medicare, which would have funding for, you know, for the kind of help that seniors might have to have to avoid, to protect themselves against the worst consequences of climate change. And that's solar batteries, heat pumps, other resiliency measures that seniors could use in the event that these catastrophic storms just sweep over the coastline communities of Florida. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I'm really excited about the Save Through Medicare Act. I mean, look, we had Hurricane Ian come through a few years ago. Mass devastation. And everybody who died during Hurricane Ian was a senior. So if we look more into that, why are seniors disproportionately impacted? Well, when the power goes out, as you know, because of our, it's something our bill looks to remedy, when the power goes out, seniors who have machines that need power to operate, whether it's dialysis, a BiPAP machine, a cooler to keep their insulin cool, et cetera, when the power goes out, because of these storms, because of the climate crisis, a lot of them are suffocating or dying because they don't have the medical devices they need. So our Save Through Medicare Act is really exciting because it puts money in, number one, strengthening Medicare, which is a justice issue on healthcare. Number two, giving a human resiliency to the climate crisis and making sure that people have green, friendly external battery sources so they can keep their machines running so our seniors are safe. So really, the Save Through Medicare Act is a good example of kind of how this issue is intersectional. It's about healthcare. It's about the climate crisis. It's about protecting our seniors and protecting the most vulnerable people.
Perfect. And again, the Green New Deal is intersectional.
Yeah.
It's old and young.
Yeah.
But it's all regions of the country. But it's also interspersed, interlaced with other issues.
Yeah.
You know, so the March for Our Lives movement, you know, something terrible happened down in Florida. And a young generation has risen up to say the NRA should stand for not relevant anymore in American politics, right? So you actually have young people who are lashing all these issues together as a generational, almost battering ram to knock down the old system. So can you talk about those, just those two issues and how they intersect and how young people, your talking to Seatham was all part of one larger Green New Deal movement.
Exactly. Well, you know, before I ran for Congress, I was the national organizing director of March for Our Lives, the organization that came out after that shooting. And something that was really important to me and the whole network was, how do we work in collaboration with other movements that are fighting for other issues when all of our issues intersect? Yeah. And so we came together and created this kind of coalition table between March for Our Lives, Sunrise Movement, United We Dream, and Dream Defenders, all handling kind of different issues, but that completely intersect. Mm-hmm. And we know that the climate crisis, as things get worse, as more people are displaced, and as people are pushed to the brink of humanity, that gun violence goes up. And so it is in our best interest as a movement that wants a safer community to ensure that communities have clean water, that we're doing everything we can to get to zero emissions, so that way we can defeat the climate crisis, mitigate those impacts, and that way people don't feel the need to use a gun to solve their problems. So this is like one example on how everything's together. And the Green New Deal helps in this too, obviously creating good paying union jobs for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people, putting them to work, which attacking poverty also helps end gun violence too. So perfect. It's all connected.
You know, so here we are, largest climate bill of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Unleashing wind, solar, battery storage technologies, all electric vehicles, mm-hmm. creating jobs by the hundreds of thousands.
Yep.
And all, by the way, politically possible because of the young generation. Mm-hmm. And now we have this challenge. Like, are young people enthused this year? Are they going to come out and vote? You know, and on the one hand, you say, oh my goodness, we just passed the largest climate bill in mm-hmm. history. And it's still not enough. We have to do even more in mm-hmm. the future. But, you know, and the numbers are unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, since Joe Biden's become president, we have the lowest black unemployment in history.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time in American history, there are more black young men in college than in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And all this is happening since Joe Biden is president.
Mm-hmm.
All this is happening in this era that we're in right now. And we're fighting now with, you know, as a united coalition against the NRA, not successful, but still moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your message to this young generation? What's on the ballot in November in terms of this entire agenda?
Well, and I'd say we've seen a lot of successes, too. I mean, I think for the first time in history, the gun violence prevention movement is more powerful than the NRA. And we saw it with the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act being passed 2 years ago, the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which was my first bill that I introduced, becoming law through executive action last year. And so
explain that a little bit.
Well, you know, this is a ask of the gun violence prevention movement for a few years. It was, we need a federal Office of Gun Violence Prevention. We don't have one. And when I got to Congress, you know, as an organizer, you look around and say, what tools do I have? As a congressman, what's a new tool I have? Legislation. And so the first bill I introduced was to create an Office of Gun Violence Prevention. A few months passed, and after pressure and working together with the movement and the administration, the president took the bill and implemented it via executive order. Now we have a federal Office of Gun Violence Prevention staffed by survivors of gun violence.
Congratulations. That's great.
Yeah, it's like such a testament to when the movement and people within the system and elected office work together for a common shared goal. And we saw that through the IRA, which I love. You know, Alexandria says the IRA is like the deposit on the Green New Deal.
Right.
And so that's what comes next. And so it's part of the reason why it's so important we make our voices heard.
And
in
I will
elections.
Tell you, because, you know, you and I have been working in both of these areas.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last 3 years, I've been able to put $50 million into the federal budget. So for the first time, the Centers for Disease Control mm-hmm. can study the causes of gun violence in our society.
Mm-hmm.
It's been blocked by, you know, right-wing ideologues. But now they have the $50 million at the CDC to give us the study. NIH, give us the mm-hmm. study. What makes us different than the rest of the industrialized world?
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is absolutely made possible because of great young leaders like mm-hmm. you who have just changed the dialogue in our country. And I just think it's just so important that ultimately, young people get out again this year. It's all on the line. Democracy's on the line. Climate change is on the line. Gun safety's on the line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, justice in general, healthcare, and voting and
Everything.
Yeah. All of it's on the
line. And it's about up and down the ballot from the top, obviously, and also just making sure we're electing climate-friendly Green New Deal city council members and the people in the state legislature and et cetera. We've seen a lot of Green New Deal resolutions passed at cities, which means now our municipality is going to focus on making sure that in our space, we do everything we can to defeat the climate crisis, which I think is a testament to the movement, too. So we need people to go out and make their voices heard so we have good people everywhere who actually give a damn about our lives.
And I just had a union leader up in Boston last weekend come to me and say, I just got elected. And I looked at him. He was like 35. I said, what was your platform? He says, oh, I ran on the Green New Deal. We need offshore wind jobs. We need solar jobs. We need all these new jobs. So I'm moving on to where the union jobs are going to be, where the young people are going to want to have not a job, but a career for the rest of their lives, working on installing all of these new technologies. Mm-hmm. And so it's just so great to have you as part of this. And by the way, this guy is like a cultural phenomenon as well. He's like a bridge intergenerationally, culturally. He likes Elton John and Joni Mitchell. And I might even have a question for you.
Yeah.
Here, that, you know, might show how you're up to date, too,
okay.
with the modern culture. Yeah.
All right.
So what we do here on our show is we have a little game, and the game is Big Oil or Movie Villain. So I'm going to read you a quote.
Okay.
That was uttered either by a Big Oil executive or a movie villain.
Okay.
I'll read the quote. You tell me who that person was.
All right. Let's do it.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Ready to go.
This was meant to be alternative fuel's greatest moment. But today, everyone will race back to gasoline. They'll come to us. And they'll have no choice because they will need us and they will finally respect us. Big Oil, movie villain.
I'm gonna say Big Oil.
Movie villain.
Ah,
it was okay. Sir Miles Axelrod in the movie Cars 2 as he tried to remarket gasoline as a clean alternative fuel source. So that sounds familiar. And again, it's hard to tell the difference
between
a movie villain and a Big Oil villain.
Yep.
Okay, here's one more.
Okay.
I do not think there is any silver bullet here. I do not think there's any silver bullet here. Big Oil or movie villain?
Because the last one was movie villain, I'll say Big Oil.
Big Oil.
That was
Stephen Simon, the senior vice president of ExxonMobil, when asked what could be done to lower gas prices at my 2008 hearing on oil company profits in the House of Representatives. So, ready? One more?
Yeah, let's do one more.
This is it now. Quote, run out of gas, out of time, out of money. You're just doing what you can, just making it run. What do you think? Big Oil, movie villain?
Sounds like a movie villain.
Well, I have to be honest, it was a little bit of a trick question.
Okay.
That was Boy Genius lyric from the song $20.
Oh, wow.
My staff told me you might like that one.
No, now I get to get dragged online. It's perfect.
Yeah, well, you are a boy genius, okay? So
perfect.
So that's the that's the hard part.
Maybe they were quoting
that, the movie. You know what?
There we go.
A little bit of research might find out that at the bottom of it is the big lie is coming out of Big Oil.
There we go.
So I just can't tell you how great a job you're doing and what needed generational leadership you're providing and inspiring others, you know, to get in the game, like you're saying.
Yeah.
City council, school committee,
everywhere.
State representative, just get in. Don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. Raise your hand. Fight for the future.
Exactly.
And you're the embodiment of it. If you Google the future, your picture comes up.
No.
So thank you, Maxwell.
Thank you
for being on the show.